One of the things I never do on this show, or almost never, is read to you because, man, there's nothing worse than listening to someone drone on. But I think you'll make an exception for this. When, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume, among the powers of the earth, the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. Do you recognize that? Yep, it's the preamble to the Declaration of Independence, or at least the first part of the preamble. And did you notice also that reference to nature's God? Which God are we talking about that? Or which God was Thomas Jefferson talking about? Today, we'll try to figure it out. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and it's all about nature's God.
Your Weekly Constitutional is hosted by Professor of Law Stuart Harris and underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier.
The preamble to the Declaration of Independence, and oh, don't start reminding me the Declaration's not the Constitution, I know, but it's still pretty darn important, isn't it? The preamble to the Declaration of Independence talks about the laws of nature and of nature's God. It's one of those references that many religious people will look at and take some comfort from. I mean, here's Thomas Jefferson, here's the Second Continental Congress. They're making a specific reference to God. And it's often cited as evidence of the Christian beliefs of our founders. After all, we're a Christian nation, and they're all a bunch of Christians at the Second Continental Congress. And look, they said it right there. But is that what the phrase nature's God means? Well, we can talk about that. And one particular fellow who we're going to talk to here in just a minute, a fellow by the name of Matthew Stewart, has written an entire book called, appropriately enough, Nature's God. And he goes back and he looks not just at the Declaration, he looks not just at Thomas Jefferson, but he looks at lots of the things, lots of the philosophical tracts that Jefferson was so fond of reading that preceded the Declaration. And not just by a few years, though certainly we're going to talk about that, but by, in some cases, thousands of years. You see, Matthew Stewart is a philosopher. He's one of those fancy fellows who got a PhD, or the English equivalent of a PhD, back at Oxford. Before that, he was at Princeton. And I heard of him because you may recall that some months ago, I spoke to his wife, a woman by the name of Catherine Stewart, who had written a different book on a different subject called The Good News Club. Do you remember that episode? That was a good episode. If you didn't hear it, you should go onto iTunes and find our podcast. But at any rate, after I finished my fascinating interview with Catherine, she said, hey, you really need to talk to my husband, Matthew. He's written this book all about the founding era and about nature's God, and I think you'd really like it. And guess what, Catherine? You were right. Great book, great discussion with Matthew Stewart.
All right. Well, who are you and what do you do?
Who am I? Well, that sounds like a big philosophical question. I have a name, like Jim Croce, I guess. It's uh-huh. Matthew Stewart. I guess I've spent most of my life avoiding any obvious label. Right now, I guess the one thing that would justify my existence to people outside the immediate family is that I write books. I write mainly about ideas, mainly about history. It's part of figuring out how to make sense of the world, how to make sense of where we are, and make some small contribution to how other people see the world. So I guess that's abstractly what I do.
Matthew, you sound like a bit of an egghead.
I guess I am. You know, I'm an academic monkey or something like that, and of course only an academic would put it that way, right?
You and I crossed paths some years ago, though I don't know if we ever passed any words at all. You were 2 years behind me at Princeton, weren't you?
I was.
Yeah, you were class of 85, and you were one of those philosophy types, and you hung out with all the philosophy people who wore the black turtlenecks and smoked cigarettes heavily, I'm guessing.
I don't know if that's quite right, but I definitely was one of those types that was not seen too much during daylight hours for both good and bad reasons. I was actually doing political philosophy, not pure philosophy at Princeton. So I was, I had my head buried deep in Machiavelli and Nietzsche and Plato and all that kind of stuff. I wasn't one of the guys who was, trying to figure out whether a time traveler who gets married commits bigamy and that sort of philosophical kind of problematic that the analytic philosophers were doing at the time.
Well, maybe our paths crossed once or twice. I seem to recall that I took a course in, called Introduction to Moral Philosophy with a fellow named Nagel, and that was the only, and that would have been a year or two before you got there. But this is sounding like old home week, so I guess we can get beyond this. At any rate, you were a philosophy type, and you had a very, very prestigious scholarship, the Sachs Scholarship, which means you must have done very well in your studies. And then you went off to Oxford, right?
That's right, and let me say I'm happy that you mentioned the Sachs Scholarship because I've now gotten re-involved in that scholarship. I mean, it's a scholarship that's run by the former scholars. It's a self-perpetuating thing, and I'm now the grand chairman of the thing, which I think means that I have the most free time of any of the scholars right now, and it's really terrific. So I go back to the campus and organize interviews where we get to sit back in our chairs and cross-examine the bright young things and learn a lot about what's going on, today with young students. So it's really a fascinating thing. For me, it was a great opportunity. I just had a terrific time at Oxford. In some ways, it was a less academic experience for me at Oxford. Princeton was, very intense, very scholarly, and Oxford was more about, seeing the world. So it was really an amazing opportunity for me.
Well, I'm glad you had it. What exactly is the Sachs Scholarship? Is it simply a general scholarship for academically highly qualified students, or is it specifically about philosophy and political philosophy and that sort of thing?
Well, it's named after Dan Sachs, who was a graduate of the class of 1960 and a Rhodes Scholar who died tragically young. And the real purpose is to just support people who might, in some vague way, end up serving the public. But I guess the interesting thing is that historically, the people who've participated in the program have always had a very, very broad view of what constitutes public service. I mean, otherwise, obviously, I would not be involved in the program. But there are others who I think, more represent more obvious contributions to public service. I mean, Elena Kagan is a former Sachs scholar, as is Anne Marie Slaughter. Both of them, obviously, very distinguished careers in public service. But there are many others who are, making contributions, who are, working in a wide variety of fields. But the idea is that they all, in some way, contribute to public service. And I guess, my link is perhaps the most tenuous of all, right? And I've been interested in philosophy, but I said from the start that my interest in philosophy is really about communicating it and trying to make it available to a wider public. So I guess that was my angle on public service, and I've been trying to live up to that high ideal for a while.
And doing quite a great job of it, I'm sure. But somewhere along the line, you decided that you did not wish to pursue academic philosophy. I mean, you certainly had the chops for it. It looked like you were heading in that direction. You get off to Oxford, and then what happened?
Yeah, well, I did get a DPhil, or the Oxford equivalent of a PhD in philosophy. In the process of going through that, I frankly got disillusioned with academic philosophy. And I don't think my experience was unique in this respect. I think that many people come to philosophy with a real deep passion and a real curiosity about how the world works, and also a conviction that philosophy has mattered a lot in the past, that it made a big difference in the world. And then, like me, these aspiring philosophers find themselves in academic departments where, it's a little harsh, but you get involved in the kind of hair splitting and the microanalysis and the discussions that seem to be, hermetically contained so that no one on the outside could possibly ever take an interest. And also, in
Matthew,
particular.
you're describing legal academia.
Well, that's true, but then the legal academics end up becoming judges, so it's very important that someone figure out what's going on there, right?
I guess so. I guess so. Please continue.
But so the academic philosophers just end up becoming academic professors, where they continue the dialogue. And I don't want to be too harsh, because I admire many academic philosophers, and I think they do valuable work. And to some degree, my disillusion was just a youthful rebellion. And maybe if I'd been a little older, I would have adjusted to the harsh truths of pursuing an intellectual life in the modern world. But be that as may, one point I will make about the analytic philosophy world that I encountered at Oxford is that its lack of a historical sense I thought was just really debilitating. So you would find these analytic philosophers engaged in certain projects. Like when I was at Oxford, Michael Dummett was there, and he was very keen on developing a theory of meaning. And it sounds like a nice project when you describe it in the abstract. But then if you look at the preceding history of philosophy, what you see is that it's, in many ways, it's just going through, it represents a part of a cycle that keeps going over and over over the same ground and using slightly different terms. So it's the lack of awareness of what had gone before, and the fact that many people had already pursued some of these general approaches to coming up with a generic theory that would sort of explain everything. The lack of awareness that all this preceding history was there, I thought, made it all kind of naive or guarantee that it would become irrelevant.
That is remarkable that you're saying that, because I've pointed out many times on this show and elsewhere that most of the debates we have in constitutional law have been had many times before, with, as you say, perhaps slightly different nomenclature, slightly different diction. But we've been debating many of these things since the founding, and since well before the founding of this nation, and we continue to do so today. And so that's why we always strive to put things into context. I sometimes wonder, not to get too philosophical on you, but I sometimes wonder whether, at least in the humanities, whether there are any original thoughts left.
I think that's a really important point to always bear in mind in the humanities. And I think we have to be okay with the realization that maybe they aren't so original. I mean, part of the problem I found with analytic philosophy was that by conveniently forgetting the past, it could imagine that it was engaged in this very rigorous scientific project, that it was really, exploring absolutely new ground that no one had ever seen before, and it could do so through a quasi-scientific approach. And the lack of awareness of history made that possible, but it also refuted it. So I think we should be okay with the fact that there isn't that much that's original. What's more important is developing the understanding. It's synthesizing all of this stuff that is out there in some form or other. Just because Plato said it doesn't mean that you can't say it again, and it doesn't mean that it isn't worth remembering it, because it's that, it's bringing all those things back and making them useful, making them fit together, that is the real contribution of the humanities, I think. And it's not engaging in pseudoscientific projects that are supposedly going to, add incrementally to our knowledge of some microscopic field.
Yeah, I wonder to what extent it's sort of willful ignorance, because, of course, it's the dream of every academic to be that person who came up with the paradigm-shifting idea, the Einstein of philosophy. But unlike the natural sciences, I just don't know if there is anything that's that original. And so perhaps we should content ourselves with simply putting our spin on an unending debate that goes back millennia.
Right, right. And I want to beat up on one other group of people, too, now that you've got me going. So I had this disillusionment with the project of analytic philosophy, but I was in graduate school in the 80s, and the other flavor of the decade was, I guess, what you'd call generically postmodernism, right? And this is when everybody who wanted to be a credible graduate student had to read a little bit of Derrida and speak in this kind of obtuse jargon of postmodernism. And I found that even more intellectually repellent than the pseudoscientific approach of the analytic philosophers, right? So, that was another reason that I kind of veered away from an academic career at that time.
Matthew, we are soulmates. Whenever I hear the word deconstruction, my stomach begins to get roiled. And when I heard people mention Derrida, I I just wonder why they waste their time. But we stray. This is a fascinating digression, but we do need to get to your later work.
And we'll do that right after we take a little break. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm speaking with Matthew Stewart, the author of Nature's God. And when we come back, we'll have our quiz, and then we'll talk some more with this fascinating fellow. Stick around. Well, once again, it's that happy time when Doug Smith, also known as the Riddler, comes into the station and poses one of his green-tinted riddles.
Hello, Stuart. How are you?
Always good to see you, Mr. Riddler. What's going on in Montpelier these days?
Oh, man, Montpelier, this time of year, every time of year, Montpelier is just beautiful.
It is gorgeous. Really is. Yeah. But when I was out there recently and saw all the colors, I was just stunned. This is stunningly beautiful weather.
Well, I have to say that in my 3 years at Montpelier, I'm not sure that I've ever seen the property look this good.
Really?
It's amazing. You know, we have this new CEO, Kat Imhoff.
Right.
Under her leadership and the team she's gathered together, the property looks spectacular. People, when they come to the property, they just rave about this experience that they're having, both in the house and outside of the house. It's wonderful.
Their eyes actually do get wide. It's a stunt. And you're walking along and you'll look at someone and they'll just look at you and smile. And you have this sort of silent acknowledgement that you're walking through heaven. But at any rate, we're supposed to be doing a quiz. And I completely went off on a digression. What is your riddle today, Doug?
Oh, well, I have a good one today, Stuart.
Okay. Well, before we pose it, do we have anybody on the line?
Good morning. You have Ron Lafferty from Prestonsburg, Kentucky.
Prestonsburg. That nice. Is in East Kentucky, isn't it?
That is.
All right, Doug, do you have a good riddle for Brian?
You know, that's like a CCR album.
Watching the Fog Rise. Yeah, that would be a good song, wouldn't it? I agree with you.
I've got a good riddle for you. Here you come. Ready, Brian?
I'm ready.
Mr. Henry was known for his preaching, "Give me liberty or give me death." But he refused to attend the convention, for he smelt a great rodent with heft. What did Patrick Henry smell that kept him from the convention? Was it A, a possum, given that he was from Hanover County, Virginia?
Mm.
A rat, option B.
Ugh.
Option C, a raccoon hat, something near and dear to the Kentuckians. Or D, an elephant, given his interest in Republicanism.
Do you need to hear those again, Brian?
Yeah, one more time, please.
All right. Mr. Henry was known for his preaching, "Give me liberty, give me death," but he refused to attend the convention, for he smelt a great rodent with heft. What did Patrick Henry smell that kept him from the Constitutional Convention? Was it A, a possum, B, a rat, C, a raccoon hat, or D, an elephant, given his interest in Republicanism?
I'm going to say a rat.
Why would you say that? That's the grossest of all the choices, and you went right to it. Why did you pick the grossest one?
Probably because it sounds a little cliche now to say, hear people say, "I smell a rat," and it is the grossest one.
Well, that's impeccable logic. How did he do, Doug?
Well, he got it exactly right. Patrick Henry smelt a rat, and there was no way he was going to go to the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia.
Yeah. Well, congratulations, Brian. That's just marvelous. You not only get your
awesome.
Your pocket constitution from Montpelier, but you'll get your YWC t-shirt. And in fact, I will ask you to go ahead and send us an email at ywc@montpelier.org and specify your address and your t-shirt size, and we'll put one of those in the mail to you. And we're very, very pleased to have you on there. But before we go, I want to comment on this. It was a huge mistake, wasn't it, Doug?
It was.
Just a huge mistake because, I'll let you tell why.
Well, unfortunately, he was the largest critic of the largest state. Had he gone to Philadelphia, he could have derailed Madison and all of the convention delegates that redrafted what became the U.S. Constitution.
He would have been a huge wrench in the works, right, and probably could have stopped everything. And interestingly enough, by the time, that's one of the reasons the convention had its rule of secrecy, just to keep people like Henry in the dark. And when finally they approved and sent out for ratification this document, that's finally when he joined the battle, and he almost defeated it then in Virginia.
Right. Yeah, the Virginia Ratification Convention, he spoke more than anyone. And to be honest with you, it was really to his demise. Had he not spoken quite so long and so quite so often, he may have been able to derail it in Virginia.
Yeah.
But, you know, Patrick Henry, he just did not balance or weigh the political realities, and he missed two opportunities to derail what he really fought vehemently against.
He did, and that's kind of interesting to me more generally, is that he was a great orator, and he was fantastic. Madison was not, but Madison was the real politician. Madison got things done. He did so quietly, and so this really can be seen as a triumph of quiet, practical political work over bombast and oratory.
Madison was really the intellectual heavyweight in the room. He did the politicking he needed to do, both before the convention to get people like, you know, George Washington even there,
mm-hmm,
and then afterwards. And when it came down to the Virginia Ratifying Convention, it's Madison that is able to meander his way around the arguments of Henry and ultimately defeat Henry and his side, but by very thin margins.
Does it sound like we're favoring James Madison here a bit, Brian?
Just a tad.
Okay, that's just how we roll. Okay, this is his house. It's his show. So sorry, Patrick Henry, but congratulations, Brian.
Well, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Doug.
You bet. Hey, it's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking to Matthew Stewart, the author of a book called Nature's God. Now, that phrase, Nature's God, comes straight from the Declaration of Independence, and Matthew has been trying to figure out exactly what Thomas Jefferson meant when he used it. Matthew himself is a fascinating fellow, and we've been spending a fair amount of time talking about his own personal journey, starting at Princeton and then off to Oxford. And now, as we shall see, that journey takes a strange twist before he actually gets down to the business of writing books.
The next phase in your life, I find absolutely, if you don't mind my saying so, hilarious, because you did something that a cynic would say was simply selling out. You went off to become a business advisor, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it wasn't all that well planned. I mean, I just had kind of decided negatively what I didn't want to do, which was become an academic, at least not immediately. And I kind of raised my hand, and the first job that came by, which just happened to be a job as a management consultant.
Management consultant, right. And how old were you at that time?
Yeah, I was 25, and I had absolutely no experience in business or management. I mean, it was about as insane as you can imagine. I mean, I barely even had a business suit that fit. It was it was pretty sad.
What was that? There was another fellow who was at Princeton when we were there, a year or two ahead of me, and he's written a number of books, and his first was Liar's Poker.
Oh, sure. Michael Lewis,
and he's a fabulous writer. He's written he's written a bunch of stuff, and he's had some of the stuff made into movies now. But I recall vividly when I read about his experiences as a management consultant, or no, he was an investment banker. He was 24 years old, and he had some comment along the lines of, why were these people trusting a 24-year-old with billions of dollars?
Yes, exactly.
And in much the same fashion, why were they trusting you with telling them how to run their businesses when you didn't even have a business suit?
Well, that's right. And I wrote a book where I was grappling with that paradox, and I'm not sure I was able to answer it. What I will say is that, you know, I was definitely part of a big movement, and this wasn't, you know, some idiosyncratic thing that just happened to me. It was at the time, and Michael Lewis was around this same time, there was just this giant sucking sound coming from Wall Street and from the management consultancies, drawing in bright young things, because somehow these firms were able to turn these bright young things into hard cash. You know, and there are a number of different plausible explanations, but none of them really justify what happened, unfortunately. They just explain it. You know, the world was and is very uncertain for managers of large corporations. Things are changing quickly. They need to be able to pass the buck in a certain sense. So they conjure up this idea of expertise, and it turns out that it's not that hard to manufacture expertise. You just need bright, shiny young people wearing good business suits, which I got. I mean, I got some very nice business suits.
Let me just – I've often had a theory that – and you've just kind of touched upon it. These managers are running billion-dollar corporations, and they are making decisions that have enormous impacts. And are you guys, you management consultants or former, are you just somebody to blame in case things go wrong?
Yeah, I think a lot of it was about that, or we're a shoulder to cry on, and also someone to blame, someone that you can fire, and or to put it even more bluntly, someone who will do some of the firing for you. So yeah, a lot of it is that. A lot of it is just sort of shuffling off responsibility, and sometimes that's not even. I can't even say it's unreasonable, because sometimes, you know, this is why people call in witch doctors. There's actually a rational justification for using witch doctors. Uh-huh. Even though poisoning a chicken is frankly very unlikely to really give you usable empirical results, the practice of having one there with you can sometimes, you know, facilitate conversations and make certain kinds of change possible. So it's not totally irrational, but I think on the whole, you know, looking back on it, I see the whole enterprise as more of a symptom of a problem than any kind of solution. You know, it's kind of like therapy con bad. You know, it's basically not a cure, but just a sort of reflection that there's some underlying trauma or dysfunction.
Well, if the book writing thing doesn't work out, and if my legal education thing doesn't work out, we'll get together and we will form the Witch Doctor Consulting Group. And we'll make another. You already made one pile of money on Wall Street, but we can make one together. I sometimes regret the fact that I seem to be the only fellow back in the 1980s who didn't get on that particular bandwagon, and this may be my chance.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear you say that, because about feeling that sense of there being a bandwagon, because I think that was part of what was going on too. Is that I'd reached the age of 25. I was unhappy with the academic world, and I just saw these kids who were even younger than me going off and, you know, doing all this crazy stuff and making all this money. I thought, am I missing something here? Am I, you know, what's happening all around me? And so I just jumped on the train for a while.
Well, eventually you got off, and eventually you started writing about it, and you'd have a series of just fascinating books that are all out there, and we could probably take the rest of the hour and just talk about them. But I want to talk about the last one, if you don't mind. I had your wife, Catherine Stewart, on the show several months ago, and she told me about her fascinating book, The Good News Club. And after we finished that interview, she said, oh, you probably also want to talk to my husband, because he's written one about the founders and about the philosophy of the founding generation, and it's called Nature's God. And boy, what an interesting concept, an interesting book, and I think that's what I'd like to talk about, if that's all right with you.
Yes, that'd be great.
Well, tell me about it. What is this book about?
Well, let me tell you how I came to it, so we can build up slowly. There are a number of pieces that sort of drew me in. So my background is in the history of philosophy, and I've always been very passionate about my dead philosophers. And I guess if I had particular interest, they would be in the ancient Greek world and then in the early modern world. And I think I always looked down a little bit on the Americans, the American founders. I didn't think of them as philosophically all that sophisticated. I've always been very proud to be an American and proud of the accomplishments of that generation, but I never thought of them as philosophically sophisticated. And then about 10 years ago, I started reading into the founders. I started reading a little more closely. Some of the texts I came across are very familiar. I actually just reread the Declaration of Independence. But then I also came across some texts that are not very well known. One I mentioned at the beginning of the book, and that sort of runs like a thread throughout, is Ethan Allen's Oracles of Reason. Mm-hmm. And what I discovered in that encounter with these primary texts is that these Americans were pretty cool, philosophically speaking. I mean, they were really a lot more advanced than I had imagined. They were using a set of concepts that to me were quite recognizable, but they were recognizable because they were coming from some of the most radical and interesting philosophers of the early modern period and of the ancient Greek period. So all of that led to a kind of rethinking on my part of the philosophical significance of the American Revolution. And I I've since come to the conclusion that the American Revolution is something that's philosophically quite significant. And in fact, we haven't actually worked out all of the implications of what was going on there. More generally, you know, I mentioned we had this nice chat about postmodernism. I've always been a partisan of the Enlightenment. I mean, for me, philosophy is about the pursuit of knowledge, and the Enlightenment really is that pursuit. It's been dissed a lot in contemporary thought, and I think unfairly. And I think that when we get to the core of the Enlightenment, we find something much deeper, much more, much richer and more interesting than we've been led to generally believe in. That, and this core is what is driving, what drove the American Revolution, and what still matters today in figuring out where it's going. So that's the, you know, what attracted me in a general way. And then there were some, you know, more specific links. One I've already mentioned, there was this book, Ethan Allen's Oracles of Reason. So Ethan Allen was the Green Mountain Boy leader. Most people today think furniture store, right? So we have to clear that out of the way, right? That was done in the 1930s. That's nothing. Ethan Allen never built a piece of furniture. Actually, that's probably not true, but he was not a furniture maker. So he was the leader of the Green Mountain Boys. He was completely self-taught. He was known as a kind of a rough character. But he was also known in his own time as a free thinker, or they, you know, the devout people called him an infidel, and with good reason, because he was a free thinker and an infidel. So we don't associate him with scholarly, you know, works and, you know, great tomes of philosophy. But in fact, he wrote this 477-page book. It's called Reason, the Only Oracle of Man, a Compendious System of Natural Religion, and da-di-da-di-da. But he summarized that as the Oracles of Reason. And, you know, this book, you know, frankly, I think I was the first person to read it closely in some number of years, like in the last 100 years or so. And it's not a great book, but it's not a bad book. But that isn't really the point. What's interesting is that it just has an awful lot of ideas and arguments that are pretty sophisticated, that are drawing on a lot of the preceding history of philosophy. And I guess if there's one aspect of it that I can point to that has this sort of radical tendency, it's, let's call it the pantheistic tendency in his work. Now, he's formally a deist, okay, which means that he, you know, formally is committed to some notion of a designing deity who creates a natural world that operates according to natural laws. But as you
sort of like Spinoza?
Well, but as you probe it more deeply, it starts to look more like Spinoza. And Spinoza is more properly categorized as a pantheist. And a pantheist basically says that at the end of the day, God and nature are just two ways of talking about the same thing. God kind of reduces to nature in a certain sense, although nature in the sense that they use it is a little more interesting than our common idea of nature, which we tend to think of as some kind of inert, nasty, rock-like substance. So then the story gets the plot thickens, because here is this, you know, Ethan Allen, who'd written this book, and it has all these implicit references to previous philosophers and their concepts and ideas. But he himself said, hey, I've never read any of these philosophers. You know, he says in the preface, you know, people call me a deist, but I have no idea whether I am one or not, because I've never read any of their books. So what happened is that many years after his death, some scholars looking at his claims and his book said, well, he couldn't possibly have written his own book because, you know, it has all these references to previous philosophers, and yet he claims he's never read them. And so this theory emerged that he was not actually the author of his own book, that it was in fact written by a man named Thomas Young. And then that's the other avenue that really sort of drew me into this story, because not only did we have this rich history of philosophy that really matters in shaping the modern world, but it turns out that there are these characters like Thomas Young and the American Revolution that people haven't heard of and that they should hear about, because they're really interesting. They really accomplished quite a bit, and they had sort of ways of thinking that are worth reviving, because they teach us a lot about what happened then and in a way of who we are now. So let me talk a little bit about this character, Thomas Young. So he was born in upstate New York, the son of poor Irish immigrants. He became a doctor, self-taught, which I hate to say probably means that he killed a lot of people, because in those days medicine was really, really bad.
We're talking leeches?
Yeah, the leeches. And, you know, he would bleed people. And actually the worst thing that he did was he would prescribe calomel, which is basically a form of mercury. because the theory was that it would sort of purge people of their fevers and so on. But in fact, you know, it was just poisoning them. We now use it as an insecticide, right? He taught himself to become a doctor, but he very early was committed to a struggle for freedom against the British Empire, and he was very early committed to the idea of establishing a republic, a non-monarchical, essentially democratic form of government. And very early, he was committed to the rights of the common people, of the poor people. So he was this egalitarian, radical revolutionary right from the start, and he shows up at the very beginning of the struggle, the revolutionary struggle. So in 1764, he gets involved in some of the struggles in around Vermont. Then in 1765, he's the leader of the Sons of Liberty of Albany, which has a dramatic effect in the Stamp Act riots of 1765. He then moves to Boston just so he can get involved with the revolutionaries there, becomes buddies with Sam Adams and James Otis. He is a key figure in the response to the Boston Massacre of 1770. He helps form the Boston Committee of Correspondence in 1772. This is a really important organizational breakthrough in organizing the revolution. He then turns out to be the guy who kicks off the Boston Tea Party. I mean, it doesn't get better than that, right? He's actually the one who stands up at a crucial meeting and is the first to suggest that what the town has to do is throw the tea in the harbor. There's a couple of instances where it appears that they try to either kill him or injure him.
Not exactly a model citizen, was he?
No, he was a real rabble rouser. He wasn't the only leader by any stretch. I mean, Sam Adams was clearly the probably the biggest name at the time, although they worked together as a group. But you know, he was pivotal in the Boston Tea Party. He then had to flee Boston because he was being pursued by the British. And he shows up in Philadelphia, becomes best friends with Thomas Paine. He leads the Pennsylvania Revolution, which was a vital moment in the revolutionary struggle. You know, people don't remember, but in the spring of 1776, the middle colonies did not want independence from Great Britain, and Pennsylvania was the dominant middle colony. And Thomas Young and his buddies organized a local revolution, essentially a coup, where they replaced what was really the legitimate government of Pennsylvania with, you know, kind of their own little central committee. And so they changed the vote of Pennsylvania, which then shifted the Continental Congress towards independence. And then to cap it off, Young and his allies wrote the Pennsylvania Constitution of 1776.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with author Matthew Stewart about his remarkable new book, Nature's God, which is about that phrase, Nature's God, which appears in the Declaration of Independence. And we have just been learning, I've certainly been learning, a lot of American philosophical history that I just had no idea about. After the break, we'll finish our discussion with Matthew Stewart, so stick around. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish my fascinating discussion with Matthew Stewart, the author of Nature's God. Before the break, Matthew was telling me about a fellow you may never have heard of. His name was Thomas Young, and he was very important to the philosophical tradition that stretched back for thousands of years and ultimately informed what Jefferson put in the Declaration of Independence. In fact, it turns out that there were a lot of common Americans who contributed a lot more than we realize to our constitutional history.
That's right. And even though they didn't have formal education, so Thomas Young, for example, had no formal education, they were able to pick up quite a lot from their reading. And it shows in the way that Thomas Young was writing, for example. On the one hand, he would have all this command of these sources and this interesting conceptual vocabulary. On the other hand, his grammar wasn't always great and his style was pretty clunky. And I think you're right. It's because that there is, you know, this intelligence, this theoretical capability out there. And if you pay attention to it, you'll find that it, you know, it not only is interesting in its own right, but sometimes it has a pretty dramatic effect on the course of events. You have to look for that. But if you try to track the events in 1776 in Philadelphia from the top down, and you just look at the debates in the Continental Congress, and you have John Dickinson facing off against John Adams, and you know, the grand pronouncements coming in from Thomas Jefferson, you miss a lot of the story. I mean, a lot of it was actually driven from below, and a lot of the great, you know, heroes in marble were actually reacting to events rather than creating them.
So how would you characterize the contributions of the common folk? I mean, not just Thomas Young, but all these guys.
Well, for me, the common theme was the philosophy. So what's interesting about Thomas Young is not just that he had this role in events, but that he also put on paper some of his philosophical ideas. And those ideas are the same ones, with some nuanced differences, that appear in Ethan Allen's book, but also, more crucially, at a deep level, they are the same ones, I think, that inform the work of Jefferson, of Franklin, of Thomas Paine, and of these other, you know, great heroes of the Revolution. So I think if you want to understand the way in which ideas affected the Revolution and the way in which they then structured what came afterwards and what's led to today, this is the it's this collection of people and this collection of philosophical ideas that you have to pass through. So that's what I found interesting. And in terms of, you know, people, aside from the famous names, there are a couple others that I thought were interesting. Were Philip Freneau. He was at the time, he was pretty well known as the poet of the American Revolution. And I think he's been taught to some degree since. He was a friend of Jefferson and Madison, and in fact, he was kind of their press guy. He was sort of he got involved in some kind of quasi-scandals when he was essentially being used by Jefferson as his press mouthpiece. Yeah. So his poetry is, I don't think it's ever been considered to be, you know, he's no John Keats or William Shakespeare, but he's his poetry is interesting. And more importantly for me, it's quite metaphysical. He touches on a lot of the same philosophical themes. And he's also referencing a lot of the same sources. So he is, I think, pretty overtly a pantheist, makes him very close to Spinoza. He also was very indebted to the ancient Roman poet Lucretius and to the English metaphysical poet Alexander Pope. And so his work, I think, is very useful in, you know, laying out this kind of philosophical understructure of America's revolutionary thought. And it helps clarify what his friends Jefferson and Madison were thinking. I think Joel Barlow is also an interesting character. He started off as something of a minister, but then he, I think, had a moment of falling away and became essentially a free thinker, a friend of Thomas Paine. He shows up in France during the revolutionary period and becomes a, you know, true Republican revolutionary. Although his poetry is pretty unreadable today, you know, it's kind of turgid. I think it's got the same underlying radical message, this kind of belief in a sort of naturalistic divinity. The kind of pantheism and using that as the foundation for a new way of thinking about government and natural rights and so on. So there are a handful of characters, but I guess what I'm trying to suggest is that there's a deep philosophical substructure that we can get at. It consists of a set of concepts and also a set of sources that are really helpful in understanding those concepts. It's moving from the notion that we have to base the legitimacy of our political systems on some higher authority, which would basically be a god, moving from that concept to the idea that we have to base the legitimacy of our systems on our own authority, and that authority must ultimately come from reason. So I think that, you know, in very simple terms, deism is a kind of halfway house between traditional religion and atheism. It's basically a way of saying it's a way of slowly removing an intervening deity from the picture. And I think it what you can see in the writings of the American philosophers, as in the writings of the earlier philosophers from Europe, is that this deism naturally dissolves into a kind of pantheism. That is to say, once you start removing, once you start taking away the intervening power of a deity, that deity starts to become synonymous with just the activity of the world itself, which is just another word for nature.
So did Jefferson and these other like-minded folk, do they consider themselves pantheists?
You have to phrase this kind of carefully because, you know, people like Jefferson would not have, you know, formally agreed to call themselves pantheists in that sense at all. But I just think that that's where their way of thinking tends, right? And I'm using pantheism in a certain sense because it can be used in other ways too, right? I mean, sometimes people use pantheism to refer to the idea that they're like, that God is some kind of spirit that sort of, you know, bubbles up out of, bookshelves and tile and, you know, anything else that you see in the world, right? So that's not the same concept. The phrase nature is God, when you trace it in its preceding history and you look at it as it's used in other Americans' writings, people like Benjamin Franklin and my friend Thomas Young, you see that it has a very specific history. Today we sort of, you know, pretty much everybody who hasn't read my book is not familiar with this, the specific history of this phrase. And so it's kind of understood in this very vague sense where it's, you know, thought to be actually quite religious and, you know, is easily confused with a Christian deity. If you want to understand how Jefferson got the phrase, what it meant to him, how it fit together with the political theory that he was invoking, where it came from, well, then, no, it's absolutely wrong to say that nature's God comes from that Judeo-Christian tradition. In fact, it comes very precisely from a set of preceding writers, people like Alexander Pope, who made the phrase famous in his Essay on Man, who got it in turn from Lord Bolingbroke, who was, in my view, basically cribbing Locke and Spinoza, who was borrowing from Bruno, who got it from Lucretius. There's a preceding history that makes very clear not just what the phrase meant, but how it fit in with a much broader system of philosophy. And that system is nothing like, what we now vaguely call the Judeo-Christian tradition or with, you know, whatever varieties of Christianity were available at the time. I think the basic commitment is this one that comes up first in the ancient world, this commitment to the idea that everything in the world can be explained, that the world is intelligible, that there's nothing, things don't just sort of happen randomly. To put it another way, nothing ever comes out of nothing. The world is reasonable. So that's the kind of core commitment.
That's an idea that goes back a long way.
Yeah, these are very old ideas, and they appear in various cultures at various times. But I think the one that matters in tracing the American history is ancient Greece. And the philosopher that I think is most important in this line of interpretation is Epicurus, who, was around in the 3rd and 4th centuries BC. I think it begins with that commitment to the intelligibility of the world, the reasonableness of the world, and our access to it through reason. And when you start to apply that principle rigorously enough, you essentially make the traditional supernatural explanations for things that appear in ordinary religion, you make those not credible. Of course, you make them not credible by, you know, finding alternative explanations for events, by basically saying, no, you know, the thunder coming from the sky is not Zeus. We have an explanation. It's actually the movement of clouds and water and so on. But even at a more abstract level, you basically end up committed to the view that everything we experience admits of some naturalistic explanation, and that when we try to offer these alternative sort of Mysterian, you know, miraculous explanations where we just sort of posit some deity that accounts for it, we're not actually explaining anything at all. So that's the basic framework. Now, you might then ask, well, why is there any concept of God at all involved, right? Because you're essentially saying, well, there's all there really is nature. And I think that there are sort of two explanations for why the term becomes nature's God. One is that, of course, throughout the early modern world, basically up until now, it just was not a viable survival strategy for anybody to offer any kind of comprehensive theory of things that didn't involve God. That's a really crucial point again, because really up until the late 19th century, so you know, a full century after the American Revolution, there are, for all practical purposes, no formal atheists. There are one or two characters who show up in the history, but they're completely fringe characters. Every other major thinker, every writer, comps to some belief in a deity. But the question is all about what kind of deity? What is the nature of this God that they're believing in? And when you start to parse that out, you realize, well, functionally, they aren't actually different from what we now call atheists or non-believers or free thinkers. They simply couldn't, you know, be explicit, or they couldn't go down that particular path, because then we wouldn't have heard of them. I mean, if Jefferson had come out and said, you know, I don't believe in, you know, any kind of deity like the one that you're describing that simply doesn't exist, well, you know, he would not have become president. He wouldn't have gotten out of Virginia. He would not have basically been heard of ever again in history. And the same is true of the philosophers who preceded him. I mean, Spinoza was identified, I think, correctly as, you know, one of the great atheists of his time, and yet he proved the existence of God. And I think that there's a certain sincerity in the proof. You just have to understand what he means by God. But, you know, he wouldn't even have gotten to where he is had he not at least had some formal commitment to a notion of God. We should understand America's founders, whatever their personal idiosyncrasies and whatever their personal expressions were, we should understand them as being functionally the equivalent of atheists. Or to put it another way, yes, they made certain expressions of belief, and yes, they probably did have some idiosyncratic beliefs that we would think are a little bit strange or crypto-religious. But in terms of what they accomplished, what they actually got done, how their theological belief system fits with their political theory system, with what they actually created in the world, yeah, they were basically atheists, and we should look on them that way, and we should understand our own world in that way. I mean, we should understand that essentially we live in an atheist world. I mean, one that has been made possible by humankind's ability to break free from the supernatural, quasi-instinctive mishmash of our ancestral consciousness and, you know, produce something that is at least a little more grounded in reason. People like Jefferson and like Spinoza did have something that I think we can call fairly a sense of piety. But the important thing is that piety is attached to only two things: the investigation of nature, understanding the world, and then the other expression of that piety is the commitment to being, in their words, to being virtuous, which just means to cooperate according to the principles of reason with other people. So it's a reduction of religion to morality.
Well, I've often noted, as have many others, that even though most of the founders, most of the framers of the Constitution were nominally Christian, that they made no reference to Jesus Christ or any other deity in the Constitution. And if you're going to judge them by their words, by what they actually did, then it doesn't look like they, I mean, they could have, if they'd wanted to, created an explicitly Christian nation, but they chose not to.
That's right. And you know, John Adams, thinking back on that constitution-making process, came to exactly the same conclusion. He said, you know, in America, we produced government on the basis of reason, evidence, and experience. That's all we relied upon. And Benjamin Franklin, interestingly, made the same point obliquely, precisely at the moment when he called for prayer in the Constitutional Convention. You know, this is a moment that's been kind of hijacked by the religious right. In fact, what he said is, here we are trying to show that human beings are capable of forming a government through their own reason, on their own wits. Please, let's make sure it happens so that people in the future can realize that this is possible. So let's all pray and make sure that people in the future realize that they don't have to.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Matthew Stewart, the author of Nature's God. What a fascinating discussion. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Chad Barrett and Bob Hoffman. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our music is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.